the coup in Turkey as a teaching moment today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Zeynep Tufekci studies technology, society, and the media. She was in Turkey on vacation when that coup attempt started, and she ended up with a case study for one of her classes.
The government was saved by what remained of free press. The very forces that have been demonized are what helped save this government.
Plus, what the failed coup might mean for Turkish women.
Men are now going to feel more powerful, more empowered. They're going to feel like they don't have to answer for the things that they do to women.
And in Pennsylvania, some folks feel left behind.
Global economy. Global economy, my ass. What has it done for us? Nothing.
That and more today on The World. Thanks for being here, and you didn't even have to pass through security. The World's Leo Hornack does multiple times a day as he covers the Republican National Convention for us, a half-mile gauntlet that he compares to getting into the Green Zone in Baghdad. He'll tell us more about that later in the show. But first, she went on vacation and ended up watching a coup unfold. U.S.-based social media analyst Zeynep Tufekci was on vacation in Turkey, her native Turkey, last Friday when that military coup attempt got underway. Then she says she witnessed up close how one of the Turkish government's most reviled enemies came to its rescue.
The government was saved by what remained of free press and the fact that there were open networks and digital networks that often get throttled in Turkey or banned.
One example of what Zeynep's talking about, President Erdogan calling in via the FaceTime app to CNN's Turkish affiliate during the coup. Zeynep's now back in the States, where she teaches at the University of North Carolina. She says this was the first time in Turkish history that a coup was stopped by a popular mobilization.
I saw people jump in front of tanks, climb on top of them again and again. I saw tanks run over cars and people, and then more people rushed them anyway. The mosque network in Turkey, which is tied to the government, also started, instead of call to prayer, started broadcasting call to resistance to coup. Mm. So it was the iPhone and WhatsApp networks and the mosque networks that just started mobilizing, saying we're going to resist the coup. And I saw the effect. There were thousands of people on the streets waving flags and waving their phones, you know, taking selfies, chatting with other people. They were all out there, and I started following on, you know, TV stations, which were sometimes being taken off the air because the coup forces would invade a TV station and take it off the air. And then I would start seeing tweets and WhatsApp messages where people would say, let's go take it back, and people would go storm TV stations occupied by coup soldiers and take them back and put them back on there. It was pretty wild.
Your Turkish cell phone provider Friday night topped up your internet allowance as well as that of every subscriber in Turkey. What does that tell us?
It was pretty crazy. I have written op-eds in the New York Times talking about how the government restricts and throttles social media in times of crisis. Their first instinct is to clamp down. Last week, I used government-provided internet to write another one explaining how they embraced the internet's potential here, because what happened was the TV stations weren't reliable and there weren't cameras running around because of the situation, and there were no cameras near the president and the prime minister at times. So they had to rely on free flow of information, which you got through digital networks, to help mobilize what turned out to be a successful resistance to what had otherwise been a pretty bloody and ruthless coup.
Are you saying this was kind of government-fueled people power?
I would say it was government-fueled people power, absolutely. I know there's a lot of criticisms of President Erdogan, and I'm included in longtime critics, but it is an elected government with a lot of support. And importantly, it wasn't just the government. Every major opposition party and pretty much every major dissident, journalist, intellectual I know and follow on Twitter had come out against the coup within the hour.
Isn't there a substantive difference between people who organically rally and a government telling people to mobilize?
It's not possible for a government just to mobilize people against tanks and risk their lives if people don't want to do this. So it's definitely true the people on the streets were more government supporters, because that makes sense. This is the government being overthrown will have its base mobilize more efficiently. But I have to say, every opposition party leader came out as soon as they could, often on Twitter, because that was the fastest way, came out and said, no, this is not what we want.
But the way forward looks pretty distressing. I mean, we learned this morning that Turkey's issued a ban on academics leaving the country and called back those academics on out-of-country travel, and yesterday suspending more than 15,000 teachers and calling for the resignation of university deans. What does this mean for intellectuals and academics in this secular Muslim society?
Well, there has to be some kind of, all right, let's figure out what exactly happened and find the perpetrator. So that is understandable. What needs to not happen is to use this as an excuse to further consolidate power. The problem in Turkey has been major consolidation of power, restrictions on freedom of speech, major pressure on media, firing of independent journalists. But if you look at the actual events that happened, the fired journalists, the journalists who'd been fired because they refused to be government mouthpieces, they turned out to be the most reliable, important sources of information telling us that this was a coup and that this was a bloody coup and how it was going down. If we didn't have those independent voices, a lot of people would be skeptical. And I have to emphasize another thing. The president called in not to a TV station known as a government-aligned mouthpiece, but one that had retained some semblance of independence. Mm. And I think that was a very deliberate choice because that was the only one that had some legitimacy in confirming, yes, this is the president, and making sure that it was believable. So the very forces that have been demonized are what helped save this government. So I'm just hoping going forward, this is a moment that sees. I'm watching with a lot of concern, and I'm really worried about the reports coming in initially. And I will, as will 70 million people of Turkey, will watch to see how this happens.
I mean, we have seen a massive purge this week of 50,000 government employees. What are you looking for in the next week and the weeks after?
A lot of the government employees have been suspended. So we're waiting to see what happens to their jobs, whether they'll actually get fired or whether there'll be a quick process by which only the few perpetrators are identified and tried within, you know, democratic norms and rules of law. There's many things to be worried about. In fact, there were many things to be worried about before the coup. So my concerns about freedom of speech and rule of law stay the same. But there are reasons to be hopeful. There are reasons to think that the scourge of coups, military takeovers in Turkey has finally been eliminated. And maybe, just maybe, this can be a moment where the government that has been consolidating power for a long time actually reverses course and realizes that the free and independent media and an active culture of rule of law and dissent were essential in beating the coup. And that's hopeful.
Zeynep Tufekci at UNC Chapel Hill. She's also a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. Always good to speak with you, Zeynep. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you were glued to your TV last Friday night, as I was, watching the news of the attempted coup out of Turkey, one thing might have struck you. When President Erdogan pushed back against the coup plotters, he told Turks to pour into the streets to defend democracy. They did. But as I looked at the crowds, I couldn't see any women. Pınar Ersoy is former foreign editor for Cumhuriyet, a newspaper in Turkey. So again last night, Pınar, thousands gathered in Taksim Square in support of Erdogan and his ruling party, but most of them were men. What role have women had in the street protests since the coup attempt last week?
Well, they've been mostly absent from the streets. The groups that are at the squares are mostly conservatives, so women are not there. There are a few, obviously, but compared to men, there aren't enough. So they haven't really played a great role, I would say.
Are there no conservative women in Turkey?
There are many conservative women in Turkey. It's just that, to be honest, there are women at the squares. It's just that there are very few. Just yesterday, there was a decree by a cult, by a religious movement in Turkey, a very well-known one called İsmaila Group. And they issued a decree saying that women should sit at home and pray while men go out and support the government. So that's just one unique example, but it could help explain why women are mostly absent.
So this cult, as you describe it, is it a conservative group?
Yes.
Right. So
it's a religious group.
Does that kind of that decree, as you put it, for women to stay at home, is that kind of exemplary of how conservatives feel about women's position in Turkey?
I would say so, but I wouldn't want to say that all conservatives rather have the women at home. It's just that this one very religious group issued a statement concerning their members saying that the women should not go out to these protests and that men should.
What about some of the Occupy protests in recent years in Turkey? Were women part of those movements?
Yes, it was, I would say, 50-50. They were in the fights. They were there when they were taking over the park, the Gezi Park, which was the reason that the protests started at the first place. They slept at the park with men. It was a homogeneous group.
So the difference between then and now is that this is kind of a movement, as you see it, taken over by conservatives?
I would say so, because it's only natural, because this is AKP's base. The night of the failed coup attempt, President Erdogan asked people to go out against the coup, which luckily, you know, helped stop it. But it was his base, AKP's base, who went out, and these are conservative people. So it's just natural that they're the ones who are at the squares right now.
Mm. Pinar, you've written on Twitter that women are reporting an increase in harassment since the attempted coup. Is that affecting you personally?
I haven't had a personal experience. I've heard friends who are more careful about what they wear out to the streets. I've read a lot of accounts of harassment online. These are, of course, just people tweeting things, but I have no reason not to believe them. But I haven't had a personal experience.
Yeah, so what's going on? What do you think is the connection between these reports of harassment and an attempted coup?
Well, the fact that the crowds stopped the coup empowered them. And these crowds, not everyone in these crowds, but some tend not to be very, very respectful of women. Imagine an environment where there are very religious, very conservative men roaming the streets. There is no police, there is no law, and a very uncertain future for a country. That's what we had the very first day after the coup. Women have always been harassed in Turkey. That I don't know any woman who hasn't had an experience like that. But the fact that there were more men out on the streets, I think, increased the amount of harassment. So it's not the coup per se, it's just the fact that that lawless environment and the fact that there were a lot of men in the streets.
Have you been out on the streets reporting, Pinar?
Not reporting. I've been out on the streets. I've been to these protests, but I was just curious, so I walked by. Mm. I couldn't say that I was there reporting.
Well, as an observer of what happens in the world and as a woman, what does that feel like for you to be out on the streets right now?
There are some neighborhoods that I wouldn't go to alone.
Why not?
I would feel like there's a greater chance of getting harassed just by being there alone as a woman. I have friends who changed the way they're dressing just so that there isn't any harassment. You know, on social media, we've seen examples of women reporting that someone would come to them at this in the subway and say, "You shouldn't wear a dress." So I would think twice before I go to certain neighborhoods.
Pinar Ersoy, former foreign editor for Cumhuriyet, speaking with us from Istanbul. Pinar, thanks so much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
A quick look ahead before a short break. We sent our own Leo Hornack to Cleveland. He's usually in our London office, but we wanted to see what he makes of the Republican National Convention. Leo says he's getting mixed messages.
Everyone who arrived at the convention was given a welcome pack with lots of items from Cleveland, but some of these objects are actually not allowed in the convention center for security reasons.
More from Cleveland and Leo later in the show. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It is July, but today in Berlin, it's May Day. The German press came up with that one since Theresa May, Britain's new prime minister, arrived in Berlin for a visit. May met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel for what they're calling a working dinner, and of course to discuss next steps after Britain voted to leave the European Union. Constanze Stelzenmüller is a senior fellow at Brookings in Washington. So Theresa May's first visit with Angela Merkel in Berlin, was this more about pleasantries than hard bargaining about anything?
I don't think it was just about pleasantries, although those presumably were important to make it clear to waiting observers, journalists, that this was not a hostile meeting. After all, there's been a lot of tension around German-British relations after Brexit.
All right, so let's just listen to how Theresa May responded to a question at their joint press conference.
You asked how we'd got on in our first getting on in our first meeting. I think what is very important is we have two women here who have got on and had a very constructive discussion. Two women who, if I may say so, I think get on with the job and both want to deliver the best possible results for the people of the UK and the people of Germany.
Genau, dem schließe ich mich.
Okay, that was Angela Merkel right at the end there. What did she say?
She said, exactly, okay. I agree with you.
So what kind of dynamic do you think you'll see evolving between them?
Well, I suspect that Angela Merkel is very relieved at seeing somebody in charge who appears to have a level-headed approach to things and means business. I presume that they will have looked deeply into each other's eyes, seen a reasonable and sane person, and decided to try and sort this mess out. Germany has been particularly upset about the Brexit vote because the UK is such an important partner for Germany within the European Union, what with its liberal attitudes to trade and to financial services and its very forward-leaning foreign policy and security postures.
One headline focused on the fact that it's the two most powerful women in the world meeting today. I'm curious, what have you noticed in terms of how the media are talking about gender in their coverage?
You know, I think that that has become less and less important. I think what is more interesting, and here I think there really is a parallel between the two women, or it may be a case where Theresa May has been watching Angela Merkel and said, well, let me try this, is that Angela Merkel has been very good at putting male potential rivals in positions of responsibility and power. And then if they misstepped, if they made mistakes in disassociating herself from them and their mistakes, and they would disappear into political oblivion, and she continued in power. And I think it's noticeable that Theresa May has put the three chief Brexiteers, Liam Fox, David Davis, and Boris Johnson, in key policy positions for executing Brexit.
Are expectations higher for success between two leaders who happen to be women? In some way, they'll be better able to find common ground than two men or a man and a woman?
I remember the condescensions, the derision around women in office 20 years ago, particularly when Margaret Thatcher became prime minister. I think we're well out of that particular mindset. If anything, I think there is an assumption that these women can get something done where their male colleagues have left a trail of destruction. And it's not as though there were a shortage of other intensely difficult issues waiting on us, such as the U.S. elections, the war in Syria, the relationship with Russia, and I could go on.
Can they pull it off?
I think that they are both determined, experienced, calm, and collected women. And if anybody can, they can.
Constanze Seltzen-Mueller, Senior Fellow at the Center on the U.S. and Europe at Brookings. Thank you very much today.
You're very welcome.
I've never really thought of Snapchat as a journalistic tool. My kid took a picture of me the other day and made me look like a wolf. How can that advance any story unless I'm reporting for wolves? And yet Snapchat does have a role for journalists. For the uninitiated, Snapchat is an app that allows users to send friends short videos and photographs. And if you're a user, I'm sure you have a favorite filter. Those filters give users tons of options to mask their face or even swap faces with someone. But as I mentioned, Snapchat can be used for more than sending laughable selfies. Yusuf Omar is mobile editor at the Hindustan Times in New Delhi. So you've actually employed Snapchat for some very sensitive reporting, Yusuf. Explain that.
So I went out to Mysore, which is a town just outside of Bangalore, and there was a climb against sexual abuse, basically a bunch of sexual abuse survivors that were using the mountain as a metaphor to overcome the physical and mental traumas that they'd experienced. Here in India, it's actually illegal to identify somebody who's been sexually abused in a photograph or a video. So I needed to come up with a way to tell their stories without showing them. And traditionally, you'd watch broadcasters or documentary makers who would blur out faces, right? And I thought, there must be a better way. There must be a way we can use technology to tell this differently. And Snapchat was that technology on many levels. For a start, it allowed these young women to have the experience of choosing their own filters. They were in control of the narrative. They would define exactly how they would be represented. And in both instances, they chose this sort of dragon's mask with fire breathing out.
So it sounds like it helps to anonymize the victims. Did they open up kind of candidly as a result?
I think they did because I wasn't holding the camera. I didn't even hit the record button. I gave them my cell phone and I walked away and it was like a selfie. They were holding it out in an arm's length and looking at themselves in that cell phone, mobile phone screen. And it was quite a personal experience.
And you said a lot of these sexual assault victims chose the dragon face, right?
Yeah, exactly right.
It sounds like might have been empowering as well.
Exactly. I mean, so frequently as storytellers, we sort of impose our rationale of what a narrative should look like on somebody that you're interviewing. This was quite the opposite. They had control, and they also gained an element of trust in me. It wasn't like I was saying, oh, I'll go back to the studio and don't worry, you won't see your face. Firsthand, they got to experience what they would be represented as. And before we did that, they actually played with some of the funnier filters. They had that wolf's tongue out, as you suggested. They had the roses on the head. Mm. And that brought a sense of humor and a little bit of a connection between us before we discussed what was otherwise quite tragic and dark subject matter.
A lot of our listeners will know Snapchat as the app where the posts disappear after a few seconds. How does that advance the conversation if these kind of reveals are suddenly no longer there?
There's two things to consider with Snapchat. It is ephemeral in many respects. It lasts for 24 hours. But for many other platforms like Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, you put up a post and it lasts for about an hour and a half, and it drops so far down people's timelines that they never see it again, right? Mm. With Snapchat, every time we added a little element of that story, it brought it right up to the top of people's timelines all over again, that entire narrative. So the idea that it doesn't last a long time is true. But in that 24-hour period, you're perhaps more relevant than other platforms.
Is hacking ever a concern?
Is hacking a concern? I think it's too soon to tell. I mean, I had a journalist ask me this week whether a hacker would be able to remove that mask and pull back the details and discover the face behind the augmented reality effectively. And I don't know, to be honest. What I do know is Snapchat seems to be a very closed-off system. It doesn't play nicely with anybody else. Like, ideally, I would love to be able to control those masks. I would love to be able to tell the sexual abuse survivor that they can design their own filter to cover their faces. But I think of all the platforms, it perhaps would be one of the more difficult ones to hack.
Yusuf Omar, mobile editor at the Hindustan Times, speaking with us from New Delhi. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Sometimes Hollywood wants a Russian accent.
So I talk with my Russian accent like this, and I'm like, hi, my name's Alena Savostikova, yeah, it's Russia, I talk Russian.
But sometimes Hollywood wants Russian actors to lose the accent.
And this has been happening all the time lately, and I'm not complaining.
The Russians are coming to L.A. ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Like most Americans these days, I'm used to high security, you know, taking your shoes off at the airport, getting your bag searched before entering a concert. I can't count the number of times I've passed through metal detectors in the last year. Just know it's a lot. The World's Leo Hornack, who's normally based in London, has also stopped counting after just a few days in Cleveland. He's there covering the Republican National Convention for us, an outsider looking in on U.S. politics, but he did take a small security survey today. So, Leo, you're inside the media center now, but back up a little bit and take us on your daily journey to get inside the convention hall, the Quicken Loans Arena. Where does it all start?
Well, Marco, each day it starts, and it's quite a long journey. It starts when your Uber driver drops you off at the kind of, I guess you could call it the edge of the green zone. There's a certain area, like about two blocks away from the central stage of the convention, where, you know, drivers and taxis and things can't take you any further. And that's when you get out with all your equipment and you start walking in the sun. And it's got this sort of feeling as you transition from an ordinary city scene to gradually security dominating more and more as you get closer and closer. I mean, this morning as I was going in, I just started recording as a group of police on bicycles started passing me. And I thought I'll just count them. And, well, you'll hear what happened.
52 officers just passed us on bikes.
Right, and at that point, you haven't even reached the security line, right?
Right, exactly. And if you've been to somewhere like JFK, it's similar to that, except the fact is that as this is the media entrance, everyone has all the items that really slow down security anywhere else in a normal airport. So you have everyone is carrying, checking in, cameras, TV, equipment, laptops. Everyone has several phones. You have all these people standing in the sun, and there is a sense that, you know, this is really, every single item is being checked and double-checked and triple-checked. A real sense of a microscopic level of security. And sometimes it has slightly strange side effects. I mean, everyone who arrived at the convention was given a welcome pack with lots of items from Cleveland and sort of branded objects to do with the convention. But some of these objects are actually not allowed in the convention center for security reasons. So, you know, you're given like a sort of memorial umbrella for the convention. And then as soon as you try and actually get into the convention center, you see them piling up in the corner of the security area. Every single delegate has had to hand in their special memorial umbrella as a potential security risk. You know, what the convention gives with one hand, it sometimes has to take away with the other.
You know, getting into the BBC in central London, where you work, isn't easy. I've run that short but secure gauntlet. What about comparing the Quicken Loan Centre with a place like Parliament? How does it compare?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's interesting. There is intense security outside Parliament. You have to remember that, you know, Britain has had decades of terrorism, first from the IRA and then in the last decade or two from Islamic extremists. So, yes, there's a massive overlap. You have the same blast barriers. You have the armed police in Britain. So there is a lot of security when you go into British political institutions, but maybe not quite so to the extent of seeing 50 officers passing you on bicycles every time you try and get into work in the morning.
Yeah, I would suspect heavily armed officers around you too.
Absolutely.
On that point, what is it like for you to be surrounded by both police and people carrying guns?
It's not quite as... I mean, you'd have to be living under a rock, really, to be surprised by the fact that at the Republican convention there may be some firearms. And as I said, in Britain, we've had decades of terrorism, sadly. So if you go to Britain and check into an airport in Britain, you will walk past officers with assault rifles. I think the difference is that here at the RNC, it ties into a bigger conversation that the delegates are having about the sense of America under threat. I mean, one of the placards that you see waved on the convention floor is "Make America Safe Again." And I just wonder how these delegates who are waving that placard, how they see the need for them to walk past snipers and walk past, go through so much security. Does that make them feel more secure, or does that actually increase the sense of peril that this country is now under?
Our man in London, Leo Hornack, reporting from Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. Good to speak with you again, Leo.
Thank you very much, Marco.
All this week, our team at the convention has been asking convention goers in Cleveland what might seem like a simple question: what does it mean to be an American? The answers we've gotten, though, are anything but straightforward. To see some of our favorite replies, follow us on Instagram. Just look for PRI's The World. Now, a few weeks ago, the now Republican nominee Donald Trump visited the small town of Monessen, Pennsylvania, 30 miles south of Pittsburgh. Monessen is an old steel mill town that's seen better days. Trump made some bold promises to the crowd.
This wave of globalization has wiped out totally our middle class. It doesn't have to be this way. We can turn it around, and we can turn it around fast.
Trump will surely make a similar pitch to a national audience tomorrow night in Cleveland. The World's Jason Margolis visited Monessen to hear what people thought of Trump's message.
79-year-old Lou Mavrakis was born and raised in Monessen. When he graduated high school, he went to work in a steel mill. Driving around, he points toward an empty landscape.
This is where the blast furnaces were, over there. Blast furnace over here. Blast furnace over here. We have three big ones.
Mavrakis is now the mayor here. Locals call him Mayor Lou. He says he has 400 blighted homes and 30 downtown buildings that he doesn't have money to tear down. We drive past rows of boarded up homes with broken and blown out windows.
All beautiful homes up here at one time when I was a kid. Now look at it. Unreal. Just look. Look at all this garbage. Forgotten world, that's who we are. Just look. Does this look like the best country in the world to live in? Just look.
There are some nice parts of town, but Mayor Liu and others in Monessen are angry for being left behind. Globalization has allowed parts of the U.S. to prosper, not here.
Global economy. Global economy, my ass. Not in Monessen. What has it done for us? Nothing.
Mayor Liu is a lifelong Democrat. He says he's appealed to members of Congress, even the president, for help, but nobody responds. He's desperate, so he reached out to Donald Trump.
I'll reach out to Putin if I have to. What would you do if you was in my situation?
When Trump came to Manassas, he made bold promises to put America first. Mayor Liu liked what he heard.
Why would you take care of other countries and let your country go like this? And you've been around. My city is not the only one. Why did they do that?
Mayor Liu says he's leaning toward voting for Trump. Manassas is a Democratic bastion, but others have also been persuaded by Trump's anti-globalization message, and they have yard signs to show it.
You've never seen a Republican sign in Manassas like that for president. You know what happened? People would throw eggs at their damn house or something. But you don't see that now. People don't care. They're pissed off.
Driving around, we saw contractor Billy Hands putting a new gutter on a roof. We stopped to talk.
I like Trump.
Why do you like Trump?
I like his ways. I like his thoughts on bringing the country back together again. I like him bringing jobs back. I like the people that are want to move their companies out, and he wants to charge them for anything coming back in. He wants fair trade. So I think he's a good prospect, and I'm a Democrat.
So you're going to probably, sounds like you're going to vote for Trump.
I'm going to vote for Trump, correct.
Have you voted for a Republican before?
No.
President?
No.
Yeah, and you said bringing jobs back. Do you think he can do it?
I think he could bring some back. It's naughty. It's not going to be easy, but I think he could bring some back. You know, he's got to get companies to invest.
But can Trump actually slow the tide of globalization and bring back jobs to places like Manassas? Economist Lee Brandstetter at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh says no.
We're not going to resurrect those giant steel factories full of high school graduates and even high school dropouts that used to ring Pittsburgh. That's not going to happen.
Brandstetter says first, technological improvements mean that we don't need as many manufacturing workers as we did a few decades ago. Second, a president needs congressional approval to levy tariffs on imports or amend trade deals. Bottom line, Brandstetter says a President Trump simply can't do what he says he would, at least on his own.
It's just unconscionable. He's selling false hopes. Basically, what he's saying is we can turn back the clock, right? You can't turn back the clock.
I suggested this to Trump supporters in Manassas. Meter maid Nancy Horvath, another longtime Democrat, didn't care. She likes Trump's message.
I'm hopeful. No one's mentioned bringing back any manufacturing until he did. Even if it's just for face value to get votes, at least he's going through the motions. That's more than any Democrat did.
Mayor Liu says that's what it's all about.
Is Steele ever going to come back here? No. I understand that. The thing is, he's giving people hope that he's going to do something about bringing some jobs here. That's what the man's doing. No one else is doing that.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Manassas, Pennsylvania.
Okay, let's turn now to a job in this country that's done mostly by immigrants, picking berries. Blackberries, blueberries, strawberries. For many of us, grocery stores with neatly packed cartons of these fruit are a sign of summer. But for the migrant workers who pick and sort berries for one company, Driscoll's, those containers have also come to symbolize something darker. And a union called Familias Unidas por la Justicia is boycotting Driscoll's berries and its independent grower, Sakuma Brothers Farms. And they're asking consumers not to buy Driscoll's. Writer Natasha Varner in Seattle has been following the story. This is all happening in Washington State. What is the boycott about, Natasha?
So workers claim that Sakuma is guilty of systematic wage theft, poverty wages, hostile working conditions, and unattainable production standards. And they're basically arguing that Sakuma needs to allow the Familias Unidas por la Justicia to represent farm workers as a union so that the farm workers can collectively bargain for better working conditions and fairer wages.
What are these farm workers actually paid?
They're paid by the weight of the product that they pick. And that's a point of contention. And it's been a point of contention since the Sakuma brothers in 2013 became part of the H-2A guest worker program. And they were part of that program for a year and that suspended their participation in the program. But it basically ignited this conflict because farm workers brought in as part of the H-2A program were paid an hourly wage. And they were given certain housing conditions. And the farm workers that had been returning to Sakuma for years prior to that saw that the H-2A workers and felt that the H-2A guest workers were getting better treatment than they were receiving. So they're lobbying for an hourly wage of $15 per hour.
And that is indeed the case, that the workers on the H-2A visa program are better treated?
Yes, that's what the workers who support FUJ, the labor union, are contending. And to a certain extent, Sukuma has acknowledged that this is the case as well, because they had to reform their labor practices for all of their workers to meet the standards established by the H-2A guest worker program, including better housing for their workers.
And yet there is this call for the boycott. How long has the boycott been going on?
The calls for the boycott and the protests and work stoppages have been going on for exactly 3 years at this point. But it looks like the two sides could be on the brink of reaching some agreement. They began negotiations last week to sign a contract and memorandum of agreement that would allow FUJ to represent workers who opted into the union. So those negotiations are happening behind closed doors, and both sides have agreed to maintain confidentiality. But both sides have expressed that they feel the first meeting was a positive step in the direction of establishing the FUJ as a union to represent the workers.
So before we go on, can you just tell us what the relationship is between Sukuma Brothers Farms and Driscoll's?
So Sukuma Brothers is one of about 700 independent growers that produces berries for Driscoll's. They produce fresh blueberries and blackberries for Driscoll's. And Driscoll's opinion on this is that they stepped in after the protests began in 2013. They conducted an independent audit of the farm, and they now feel that Sukuma has met and exceeded worker demands. But they maintain that the workers have the right to unionize and to call for boycotts.
Would you say the workers are more upset with Sukuma Brothers or with Driscoll's, or do they not distinguish?
At this point, the main dispute is between the farm workers and Sukuma, and the farm workers and the FUJ feel that the way to get support for their efforts is to bring this to the multinational corporation level and to call for the boycott of Driscoll's. They've also, there's a boycott for Häagen-Dazs ice cream, which uses Sukuma Brothers strawberries in some of its frozen ice cream products. So even though the dispute is with Sukuma in particular, they think the way to get leverage for their demands is to take it to this national level.
How has Driscoll's responded to all of this?
In regards to the dispute at Sukuma, global CEO of Driscoll's, Kevin Murphy, says that Driscoll's stance is that workers have the right to boycott and to protest, but they also feel that Sukuma Brothers has exceeded the workers' demands for fair labor conditions. And Mr. Murphy said that Driscoll's stance is that since they have so many growers out there, the best way to ensure fair labor practices among this vast network of growers is to encourage workers and growers to be in a symbiotic relationship. And that in the vast majority of cases, they see that good communication can go a long way.
Natasha Varner is a writer based in Seattle. Her full story on Driscoll's and the workers who pick its berries is up now at PRI.org. Natasha, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. Okay, I can do sort of passable Russian accent, like if I have to tell joke or so, but I'm not trying to get a part in a movie as a Russian. That's when this accent thing turns into a liability for people who come to this country with their own real accents. But if you know the right people, make that the right person, you might be able to land the part. Alina Simone has that story.
Everyone in Hollywood knows, if you need a Russian actor, you call Viktor Kruglov.
When I started, it was barely any Russian people in town. I just opened agency. It was always was my, you know, dream of my childhood to be in Hollywood.
That was back in 1987, 4 years before the end of the Cold War. Viktor didn't exactly blend in, and he admits he didn't know what he was doing. So Viktor started interviewing potential employees. The only catch? He wasn't actually hiring.
I interview many agents, and I ask them how they do to work for me. And after I interview 50 agents from many different agencies, then I know what to do. And I've been doing it since. You know, just to be in business, in any business, you have to be very creative.
But no matter how creative he got, Viktor knew he wouldn't be able to make a living just representing Russian actors, even a big name.
You know, it doesn't matter how much he was making there and how popular he was here. Here he have an accent, so he's just a regular guy here.
And as YouTube personality Crazy Russian Dad explains, some accents are better than others.
People think French accent is sexy. I agree. Italian accent, sexy. Spanish accent, sexy. English accent adds 50 points to your IQ. But with a Russian accent, no. Russian accent, you sound like a spy from a bad 1980s movie, like a villain.
Roles for Russians have expanded in recent years. Victor says he has been casting more Russian doctors and limo drivers. But his advice to Russian clients? Lose the accent.
Without accent, you're American. That's it. I have few people who got rid of accent completely.
One of those people is Alyona Savastakova. She left Russia for London with her parents when she was 15. 3 years later, she arrived in LA for a modeling gig.
And my mom was watching Russian television. I don't know if it was like a documentary or it was Russian actors talking about agents. And they said that the number one agent who came out of Russia and made it in LA was Viktor Kruglov. And my mom, not thinking anything at the time, she's like, oh, since you're in LA, you should check out this guy.
Victor started sending Alyona out on auditions, but she found herself typecast.
I always booked these, like, pothead, you know, or, like, weird roles, like hipster, rebel child, or college student that's naughty, you know, fighting with her parents, you know. And I quickly realized that you can always do Russian roles, but if I want to really be a real actor, I want to play American girls. So I had to take accent reduction classes.
It took a few years, but today, her American accent is better than her Russian accent. Recently,
I was reading for the Russian part of, like, Comrade or something. And I went in and did my voiceover. I talk with my Russian accent like this. And I'm like, hi, my name is Alyona Savostikova. Yeah, is Russia. I talk Russian.
She did get a role in the film, playing an American.
So I went in for a Russian, they cast me for an American. And this has been happening all the time lately, and I'm not complaining.
Victor says it doesn't always work out this way. Getting rid of your accent depends on a lot of factors.
If you have musical ear and you can hear and you work with a coach who tell you where to put your tongue and you do exercises and you really, really want it and you work hard on it, I believe anybody can get rid of it if you're under a certain age.
Also money. A dialect coach in L.A. can easily cost $200 per hour. Otherwise, you're on your own with YouTube.
So if you take a word like Russian, it can sound like Russian. The R is different and the sound becomes elongated.
But Victor, who has never considered doing anything about his own accent, has become a local institution, casting quote-unquote authentic Russians for directors like Spielberg and Clint Eastwood, as well as shows like The Americans. And recently, he even inspired a role of his own as the talent agent Victor on a new web series we'll have to call Expletive Actors.
Well, I think we're ready to sign you. The last thing, I would like to hear your Russian accent.
Come again?
Go!
Oh, holy God.
Faking it till you make it in Hollywood. For The World, this is Alina Simone from Los Angeles.
Paula Turcas has made it, and she has not faked it. Turcas is the lead singer for a band from Romania, but based in Berlin, called Zmeitre. That's spelled Z-M-E-I and the number 3. Before her work with Zmeitre, Turcas had been trained as an operatic mezzo-soprano. Now she's fronting a band whose debut album is titled Rough Romanian Soul. Oh, and this soul music just happens to have a different time signature, instrumentation, and language than what you might expect. This is Maitre's Romanian soul, gypsy jazz, bluesy, and unique. Where else are you going to hear music recorded live without overdubbing? In the Transylvania Mountains, not far from Dracula's castle. Yeah, exactly. Amid Zmeitre's songs about political resistance, immigration, and pride, there are a few tunes with more conventional bluesy themes. We'll leave you with more of this song called Vrau un Barbat, which means I Want a Man. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow on the radio and 24/7 at PRI.org.
Mă scuzați, omul este ocupat, are și un selfie de postat. Mă scuzați, pe profilul minunat, dragostea de sine e sensibilă, face pasiunea imposibilă, imposibilă, are sentimente de arătat. Mă scuzați, omul este ocupat, mă întreb ce s-a întâmplat. Ăsta e ultimul bărbat, da, vreau un bărbat, un adevărat, vreau un bărbat adevărat. M-am săturat și vreau un bărbat, vreau un bărbat adevărat. Așa emancipat, mă scuzați, nu mai vreau emancipat, este vreo ușor de iritat. Mă scuzați, ține crema lângă pat, crema face pielea prea sensibilă și ce petisă la incredibilă, incredibilă. Nu mai vreau așa emancipat, mă scuzați, nu mai vreau emancipat. Mama lui l-a pupat în... Și de atunci este imatur, da. Vreau un bărbat mai nespălat, vreau un bărbat adevărat.
PRI, Public Radio International.